Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are happy to welcome back Dr. Michael Greger, author of the important new book, How Not to Age, The Scientific Approach to Getting Healthier as You Get Older. Dr. Greger is best known for studying the latest nutrition science and sharing that information at nutritionfacts.org and in his best-selling books. It took Dr. Greger and his team 3 years to read more than 20,000 papers on aging for his new book, which includes more than 13,000 citations. Those can be found online. They found that the number one risk factor for dying in the United States and on planet Earth is a bad diet. That is according to the Global Burden of Disease Study, the most comprehensive analysis ever undertaken on the causes of death. We are living longer, but we're living sicker. Dr. Greger says it doesn't have to be this way. We have tremendous power over our health. The vast majority of premature death is preventable with a healthy diet and lifestyle. The key is to eat whole foods, especially fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and beans, and fewer animal-based products, and is never too late to start. Dr. Michael Greger is founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and founder of NutritionFacts.org, a science-based nonprofit that offers more than 2,000 videos on virtually every aspect of healthy eating. New videos and blogs are uploaded every day. All of the information is free. NutritionFacts.org is a non-commercial public service without any sponsors, ads, brand partnerships, or paid subscriptions. Dr. Michael Greger is the author of many bestsellers, including How Not to Die, How Not to Diet, and How to Survive a Pandemic. He is the graduate of the Cornell University School of Agriculture and Tufts University School of Medicine. And Dr. Greger is featured in the brand new Netflix documentary, You Are What You Eat. Hi, Dr. Greger. Thanks so much for joining us again.
It's so wonderful to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. I wanted to start off in this conversation talking about the research, because as you write in your new book, most of the major advances made in our understanding of aging occurred in the last 20 years, and this was after you graduated from medical school. You write that much of the research you uncovered for this book was even eye-opening for you. So what has really struck you about all of the research that has taken place over the past, say, decade or so?
Yeah, you know, I learn as much as the readers writing the book. I mean, I came in with certain preconceived notions thinking I might, you know, recommend one supplement or another, and found myself shocked over and over again once I actually did a deep dive. And many of the things I really kind of took for granted really were quite surprising. So, I mean, I think some of the biggest surprises for me, was, and this is someone, you know, steeped in the nutrition world for many years now, the section on exercise, section on sleep, red wine, resveratrol, NAD supplements, vitamin D, fish, protein restriction, the microRNAs, the list goes on and on. And I just remember all those years being so excited to learn new stuff and then, most importantly, to be able to share it with others.
Right. Well, that's what makes your work so powerful, is that it's easily accessible, but everything that you talk about is based on science. And it seems like there's so much more information, exciting information, really coming out about the effect of what we eat. I mean, we make these choices multiple times a day.
Absolutely. Right. And as you noted, that really is the most important, kind of what is at the end of our fork is really the most important decision we can make. Cigarettes now only kill about 500,000 Americans every year, bumped to number two after diet, whereas our diet kills many more. Inactivity, physical inactivity is killer number six in this country. So many people, you know, some of the things like smoking, inactivity, sedentary lifestyle, not as important as what we eat three times a day. We really are what we eat. And so we should, you know, center our diets around some of the healthiest foods.
You write that most medical students are never taught about the impact that healthy nutrition can have on the course of illness. Were you taught anything at all about food, and what is being taught in today's medical schools?
Well, I actually chose to go to the medical school which had the most nutrition training at the time, which was Tufts University, because they had an attached school of nutrition. But out of thousands of hours of preclinical instruction, only 19 hours were dedicated to nutrition. And that is more than the national average, which is 4 hours. So doctors have a severe nutrition deficiency in education. Most doctors are just never taught the impact healthy nutrition can have on the course of illness. And so they graduate without this powerful tool in their medical toolbox. Now, you know, there's also institutional barriers such as time constraints, lack of reimbursement. You know, in general, doctors simply aren't paid for counseling people on how to take better care of themselves. Of course, the drug companies also play a role in influencing medical education and practice. You can, you know, ask your doctor when's the last time they were taken out to dinner by Big Broccoli. It's probably been a while.
Right, exactly. Big Broccoli is not putting ads on television. But, well, that leads me to ask you about the power of these industries, because, I mean, this is so interesting to read about in your book. It took more than 25 years, 7,000 studies, and the deaths of countless smokers before the first Surgeon General's report against smoking was published in the 1960s. You write, big tobacco was a powerful industry, and today's alcohol, meat, sugar, dairy, salt, egg, and processed food industries are using those same tactics to twist the science and confuse the public. What concerns you the most about the research that you've read in terms of big food and its trillion-dollar industry, with thousands of trade associations spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying legislative leaders?
Yeah, I think that is really a perfect metaphor. We're really like smoking in the 50s. You know, we had already had decades of science starting in the 30s linking smoking with lung cancer, but it was ignored. Why? Because smoking was normal. Most doctors smoked. The average per capita cigarette consumption was 4,000 cigarettes a year, meaning the average American smoked a half pack a day on average. The American Medical Association was reassuring everyone that smoking in moderation was not just okay, but actually beneficial. So there was this tremendous disconnect between what the actual science was saying and public policy. And as you noted, the first Surgeon General's report against smoking, which came out in the 60s, cited 7,000 studies. You'd think maybe after the first 6,000 studies, it could give people a little heads up or something. But we're talking about a very powerful industry. And we have a series of powerful industries now trying to keep people in the dark and muddy the waters around the consensus on diet. And so until the system changes, we really have to take personal responsibility for our own health, for our family's health. We can't wait until society catches up to the science again, because it's a matter of life and death.
Yeah, I think this is such an important point, because we talk a lot about how obviously personal choice is important, but we need government action. But as you say, when you look at these industries, as you write, after the processed food sector, which is led by Pepsi, the next top three food lobbies are sugar, meat, and dairy. Dairy is the only food trade group with a budget exceeding $100 million. And Dr. Greger, this is obviously about our health, but this is also very connected to the climate crisis.
Absolutely. And also connected to the antibiotic resistance crisis. There's also a role for this kind of intensive animal agriculture in the production of past flu pandemics. And so there are so many different angles that all really point towards the same conclusions, that we should eat, natural foods from fields, not factories. But these foods aren't profitable, right? I mean, the worst thing to sell is produce, fruits and vegetables, because it goes bad. It rots on the shelf. What you want is a snack cake that lasts on the shelf for a few weeks. That's how you make money. Or you sell people carbonated brown sugar water. It's almost pure profit. In fact, you have taxpayer subsidized sugar. And so, I don't know, maybe a few pennies a bottle, and then you can sell it for a dollar or two. So, you know, even if the CEO of one of these big soda companies all of a sudden got a conscience, it's not like they're trying to, you know, getting up every day, how do I contribute to the childhood obesity epidemic? They're trying to satisfy the quarterly earnings for their shareholders. And should they get a conscience, they would get booted out and replaced by somebody who prioritizes the quarterly earnings for the shareholders. I mean, that's what the system is set up to do. Unfortunately, the externalities, unfortunately, the consequences is that these companies do not have the best interests of our families at heart. And so that's why it's really incumbent on us to, you know, even though we are being bombarded by advertisements and messages for junk food and fast food, because these are the most profitable products, we really have to educate ourselves to center our diets around foods that aren't necessarily profitable for others, but profitable for our own family's health.
What are your thoughts about media coverage of these issues, major media, given the power of the lobby and all of the misinformation out there? You write that, unfortunately, what we hear in the media about nutrition is often inconsistent and confusing. There's a pressure within today's competitive journalism market for sensationalism. Media analysts suggest there may even be a purposeful disincentive to present the facts in context to sell more copies.
Well, I mean, see, what's more clickbaity? Saying, you know, putting a little ad saying, you know, new study bacon is good for you, or new study broccoli is good for you. I mean, how are you going to get clicks? How are you going to, you know, bring people to your site? Now, look, I can certainly sympathize with the media market. It's been very difficult these days. And, you know, these major media companies are being pared down. And, you know, there's this real kind of race to the bottom to promote these kind of contrarian stories. You know, I mean, how you sell papers, it's funny, paper, I don't know how many papers are being sold these days, but I mean, how you sell media is, you know, one day coffee's good for you, then all of a sudden coffee's bad for you, then coffee's good for you, or eggs are good for you, eggs are bad for you. Whereas the consensus, right, the scientific consensus going back decades as to the core tenets of healthy eating and healthy living is really, really unsexy. I mean, you're not going to sell a lot of, you know, attention and eyeballs telling people to eat more fruits and vegetables, even though that's really what the science says. In fact, there's this wonderful organization called the True Health Initiative, which can be accessed at truehealthinitiative.org. This is hundreds of the top nutrition scientists in the world. It was started by Dr. David Katz at Yale and includes, you know, all the chairs of nutrition at Harvard, past and present. Because of this crazy, you know, misinformation out there, not just, you know, in the seedy areas of the internet, but kind of the mainstream, to really come up with a consensus statement as what is the healthiest diet for human beings. It's kind of like the IPCC of nutrition. You know, you want to know about climate? You ask the climate scientists. You want to know about nutrition? You ask the people who spent their lives studying nutrition. And spoiler alert, if you go to the website, it's a diet centered around these whole plant foods, these healthiest foods out there.
The other, I love that exists, the True Health Initiative. The other thing I think that's so important to focus on is that it is never too late to make changes. And that is, again, in the science. You have a study in your book that says this.
And not only is it not too late, one needn't make drastic changes. It really isn't all or nothing. I don't want people to be intimidated by kind of the size of the book. Even just basic, common sense lifestyle factors can mean living a decade longer, not smoking, not being obese, regular exercise, more fruits and vegetables. And it's never too late, never too late to stop smoking, never too late to move more, never too late to start eating healthier. We really do have the power.
Today, we're speaking with Michael Greger about his new book, How Not to Age, The Scientific Approach to Getting Healthier as You Get Older. We are living longer, and Dr. Greger wants us to be healthier as we age. Everything he says and everything in all of his books is based on research and science. He provides so much information free of charge at nutritionfacts.org. It's an incredible site. 2,000 videos on every aspect of healthy eating. There's so much information in his new book. Let's talk about what we often hear, that we die from old age. I often hear people say, well, that's just what happens when you get older. And you write about a study of more than 42,000 consecutive autopsies. Centenarians, those who lived at least to 100, were found to have succumbed to diseases in 100% of the cases examined, though most were perceived, even by their physicians, to have been healthy just prior to death. Not one, quote, died of old age. They died from disease, most commonly heart attacks. So can you talk about this, what we hear about how this just happens when you get older? What does the science actually say?
Yeah, that was really surprising. We have this sense that we just kind of, you know, people get old enough, they just die kind of naturally. But as this study showed, when you actually, you know, cut them open and look inside, oh, they actually died from this tumor that no one knew about. Or, oh, they actually died in most cases from, a clogged coronary artery causing a sudden heart attack in people that they didn't even know had heart disease. So heart disease, number one killer, not only of centenarians, but of men and women in general in both high income countries, including the United States. But that's good news because there's something we can do about it. There's only one diet, however, that's been shown to help reverse our leading cause of death, heart disease, in the majority of patients, and that's this plant-based diet. And I mean, if that's all a plant-based diet could do, reverse the number one killer of men and women, then, you know, shouldn't that kind of be the default diet until proven otherwise? And the fact that it can also be so effective in treating, arresting, or reversing other leading killers like high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, would seem to make the case for, you know, healthy plant-based eating simply overwhelming.
There's so much science out there. Eating a plant-based diet may reduce the risk of dementia as much as threefold, but the difference in dementia rates between those older than 85 compared to younger than 65 is 300-fold.
That's why it's so important to write this book about slowing down the aging process, right? If death is from disease, then why wasn't my book, How Not to Die, the only longevity book anyone needs? In it, I just spent the first half of the book, 15 chapters, each of the 15 leading causes of death, talking about the role diet and lifestyle can play in preventing, arresting, or reversing each of our top 15 killers. But then I realized that, you know, we can triple our risk of dementia by choosing a non-vegetarian diet. We can having a high cholesterol can increase our risk of heart disease as much as 30-fold, but an 80-year-old has 500 times the risk of having a heart attack compared to a 20-year-old. And so age is the leading risk factor for death because it increases the risk of so many different chronic diseases at the same time. Even if all cancer was eliminated, we had a cure for cancer, the average life expectancy in the United States would only go up on average 3 years. Why? Because, you know, the person that survives the cancer is just going to drop dead next year of a heart attack. All the cancer did was kill him before the heart disease killed him. So if one age-related disease doesn't get us, another might. That's why instead of playing whack-a-mole, if we can slow down the rate of aging, slow down the rate of biological aging, then we can reduce our risk of all these age-related diseases across the board. And so that is certainly the dream. That's certainly been the dream of kind of anti-aging biotech, anti-aging pharmacology, and also can be the aim of those choosing these more natural diet and lifestyle approaches.
Dr. Greger, I brought this up last time you were on, and anytime we talk about health, I want to emphasize the fact that we don't want to shame people at all because we are all affected by this. I have loved ones who struggle with all of these issues. So how do we talk about these issues without feeling like there's shame involved?
I'm so glad you brought that up. The most depressing place that I ever visited in all my medical training was a dialysis unit. Anything we can do to stay out of that, it's just a terrible, terrible place. Obesity, for example, is not some moral failing, right? The Battle of the Bulge is a battle against biology. We're living in a toxic food environment, drowning in a sea of excess calories while being bombarded by these ads for fast foods, processed foods. So, you know, becoming overweight is a normal, natural response to the abnormal, unnatural ubiquity of these sugary, fatty foods that are concentrated in calories. And the same thing with the salty foods that are increasing risk of high blood pressure, maybe contributing to the strokes in your loved one. And so it's just the food industry uses these natural biological triggers, right? We evolved in the context of famine. And so for those of us who are able to seek out more, you know, have cravings for more calorie-dense food like bone marrow and brains and honey, survive to pass along those genes to our children. Cravings for salt. There's no salt shakers or KFC on the African savanna. So we had to have a craving for salt. And so that that allowed us to survive millions of years ago. But now those same natural biological urges for sugary, fatty, calorie concentrated foods for salt are the same ones that are killing us. But the food industry knows that's how you get someone to not eat just one, is you use those natural biological triggers against us. So people, you know, find it very difficult to kind of swim against the current. And so that's why in my medical practice, it really came down, what I would recommend to people is really controlling one's environment. Mm-hmm. So basically, you don't have junk in the house. And so look, if you have, you know, if you have cookies in the house and an apple in the house, you know, for a few days, you can white knuckle it, eat those apples. But eventually, you're going to have a bad day or whatever, and you're going to go for the cookies. But if there's no cookies in the house, then you look, you got to get hungry enough, you're going to eat that apple. Now, obviously, this is, you know, people live in situations where they're unable to control their environment, or, you know, they have a coworker with a bowl of M&Ms on their desk, or they're walking by the donut shop every day, or, I mean, whatever it is. But the more we can do to really kind of control our access, this is actually very similar to what addicts do, right? You don't want to have ashtrays in the house. You don't want to have things that remind you of drinking or you remind you of drug use. You don't want these triggers. And so the more we can kind of control our environment, even, you know, to the extent, you know, if you have teenagers in the house and they're going to bring junk into the house, I encourage people, you can actually get these little like lockable, like plastic, it's not really a safe. It's just like a lockable kind of plastic bin where they can put their junk in there and you just have no access to it. I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but what's not funny is these chronic diseases that are laying waste. And if we're not able to control our own urges, then we really need to kind of control the food that's around us.
Well, let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. An easy one is about coconut fat, because everybody's like, coconut oil is the greatest thing ever, and to me it's seems like a very saturated fat, so I wonder what you think about that. Also about natural sugars versus, you know, I don't ever eat any cane sugar, but I do eat a lot of sweet things, a lot of fruits, a lot of yams, things like that, and I also sometimes use a little molasses or honey and stuff like that. But the main thing I want to ask you is, I'm a vegan. I'm pretty much a vegan, unless I'm starving out somewhere and all I can get is cheese or something. And I'm pushing, I'm going to be 77 at the end of this month, and I'm real healthy. But a lot of my friends who've been in, you know, also were vegetarians, have swapped over to this extreme, you know, animal fat and meat kind of diet, and I don't think it's coming from the animal industry. I think it's coming from alternative sources. So I just was wondering what you think of those things.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Judy. Yeah, the coconut oil has really been a remarkable success in marketing, such that thanks to the internet, hawkers of coconut oil have given it this kind of health halo. And it got so bad that the American Heart Association actually put out a presidential advisory specifically saying coconut oil is terrible for you. So coconut oil, these three tropical oils, coconut oil, palm kernel oil, and palm fruit oil, or just known as palm oil, which are found in a lot of kind of like vegan junk foods, vegan spreads, things like that, are the rare plant sources of saturated fats and increase your LDL, your bad cholesterol, as much as lard does or butter does or the saturated animal fats. So we really do need to stay away from coconut oil, despite what coconut oil sellers will have us believe. And in terms of staying away from added sugars, I think it's a fantastic idea. I was afraid you were going to say, you know, so I use, you know, I don't add sugar, so I use, you know, something like, I don't know, agave or some of these artificial sweeteners. But you really nailed it. Whole foods, right? Sweet fruit, yams, sweet potatoes, these are really the healthiest forms in general. We should try to get all our macronutrients, our carbohydrates, our protein, our fat from whole food sources, as opposed to just, you know, concentrating out the carbohydrates and sugar, just concentrating out the fat into oil, or just concentrating out the protein to something like protein powder. We really should try to center our diets around, you know, real food that grows out of the ground. The one, you know, blackstrap molasses actually has a significant amount of nutrition in it. It is kind of strongly flavored, so it's not appropriate for everything. Probably the healthiest sweetener is something called date powder, which is just ground pulverized whole dates. So it's a whole food. There's a granulated form you can use in baking, but there's a powdered form that actually works fine in hot drinks. So if you want to add something to tea or coffee, that's probably the healthiest sweetener available, just because it's a whole food and packed with the nutrition you find in dates. And finally, yes, the carnivore diet craze. I mean, it's kind of a coconut oil phenomenon where there's just this, you know, this contrarian medical misinformation. You know, carnivore dieters, you know, centering their diets around animal foods, kind of like the flat earthers of the nutrition world. But, you know, unlike all meat diets, believing the earth is flat isn't going to kill anyone. But like, you know, anti-vaxxers and climate change deniers, balking at the scientific consensus can sometimes be harmful to your health. And so I would encourage people to, you know, for example, check out the True Health Initiative to find out what the experts actually say as to what to eat, rather than relying on, you know, on something you read on the internet. You know, when I was had a full-time medical practice, I'd ask people, you know, well, why do you eat the way you do? And, you know, to my surprise, I'd get answers like, oh, yeah, someone at the gym told me to, you know, to try that, you know, eat this. And I just like, really? I mean, because it is the most important decision in terms of our health, what to eat, then if there's any decision to be made based on evidence, it should be that. You know, if you want to go, you know, buy a toaster or something online, the opinions of total strangers and their reviews might actually be useful to you. But when it comes to something as life and death important as to what to feed ourselves and our families, we really should put in the effort to make sure that we are getting an unbiased source of evidence.
This is so interesting, Dr. Greger, because there are so many YouTube shows and podcasts about health. Some are by doctors and many aren't. And so there's just so much information out there. And I'm sure a lot of people are confused by it.
And, you know, it's ironically that you know, basically, if you are a doctor, if you are a physician, you're basically advertising to the world that you have little or no training in clinical nutrition. Mm. Right. And so, I mean, we should not take that as, you know, as expertise in the field of nutrition, although one would hope they would make, you know, less, you know, make, you know, talk a little less nonsense in terms of medical issues in general.
Well, thank you for the call, Judy. And we are going to take a quick break. Today, we're spending the hour with Dr. Michael Greger, author of the new book, How Not to Age, The Scientific Approach to Getting Healthier as You Get Older. Dr. Greger is a founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, founder of NutritionFacts.org. the author of many bestsellers, including How Not to Die and How Not to Diet. He is featured in the brand new Netflix documentary, You Are What You Eat. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Michael Greger about his new book, How Not to Age, the Scientific Approach to Getting Healthier as You Get Older. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Anne in Mountain View. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. What do you say, Dr. Greger, to the people who say you cherry pick studies to come to the conclusion? I have a heck of a time defending you. I'm saying, you know, go to the site, check out his philosophy, but I don't know exactly what to say. What do you say to that?
Yes, I am. Thank you for the question, Anne. I'm all in favor of cherry picking and blueberry picking and apple picking, fresh local produce. look, there's only, you know, one diet, for example, as I've talked about, you know, proven to reverse heart disease in majority of patients. And so it's like this one diet is proven to do that. It's hard to cherry pick when there's only one cherry. And that happens in so many different diseases, where randomized controlled trials have proven, you know, improvements in mental health within a matter of weeks, et cetera. And only one diet has ever been shown to do all that. And so, you know, you can challenge someone, show me any diet that can do what a whole food plant-based diet has been shown to do. And then, and then when they realize that there isn't anything out there, then you realize, well, it's really not a matter of kind of picking and choosing, because there's really not much to pick from. Now, that doesn't mean in the future we won't have new data, new studies, that may, you know, question our, you know, our current state of understanding. But until then, it really is, just a matter of you know, putting out the best information. You know, people, you know, accuse me of being biased, but you know, it's like the same reason that the website of the American Lung Association probably seems biased against tobacco. The Philip Morris Corporation actually came up with more than 100 studies showing the health benefits of smoking. For example, nicotine may help schizophrenics with psychotic symptoms. Smoking may affect immune function, sufficient to benefit ulcerative colitis. The tobacco industry used these studies to accuse former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop of quote-unquote selective reporting when he argued that smoking causes cancer. But, you know, the reason Dr. Koop chose to focus on anti-tobacco studies is presumably because he was trying to accurately reflect the totality of the scientific literature, right? The best available balance of evidence strongly suggests smoking is bad for people's health. And the same could be said for many foods. So when the tobacco industry dismisses public health professionals as being biased against tobacco, of course they're biased against tobacco. They're public health professionals. To be biased against smoking is to be biased against death and disease. That's kind of our job.
Mm. Well, and also, Dr. Greger, I mean, what we're doing is not working right now. I mean, according to the CDC, 6 in 10 Americans live with at least one chronic disease like heart disease, stroke, cancer, or diabetes. I mean, we all have loved ones, or we hear about new cancer cases or strokes or what have you on a regular basis. What we're doing right now is not working.
And what's shocking is that we know what to do. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's just a big black box and what are we going to do? And we've known about this for decades. So Dr. Dean Ornish's landmark lifestyle heart trial, proving for the first time the reversal of heart disease with a plant-based diet and lifestyle program, opening up arteries without drugs, without surgery. That was published summer 1990, right? We're talking over 30 years later, and hundreds of thousands of men and women continue to die unnecessarily from heart disease when we've known the answer for decades. Unfortunately, the system is just not set up to, you know, disseminate information that is not going to, make the system much money.
Well, and as you point out, eating more pro-inflammatory foods has been tied to higher risks of prostate, breast, ovarian cancer. High dietary inflammatory index scores are also associated with heightened risks of stomach, liver, colorectal, kidney, and bladder cancers, as well as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So what are some of the high inflammatory foods?
Yeah, in fact, aging itself can be thought of in part as an inflammatory disease. A single blood test for inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein can predict physical and cognitive performance, as well as remaining lifespan in elderly individuals. But thankfully, excess inflammation can be extinguished through changes in diet. Those eating lower on the dietary inflammatory index, which is just created by having people eat foods, measuring the amount of inflammatory markers in their blood. If it goes down, it's an anti-inflammatory food. If it goes up, it's a pro-inflammatory food. And so you can add them all up and see if you have an overall pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory diet. And those eating less inflammatory diet in middle age are more likely to age successfully, defined as living independently with no major chronic diseases, depression, or pain, and overall, you know, self-perceived social, physical, mental health. So it is, and so in fact, that's one of the aging pathways, inflammation I talk about in the first part of the book. So what can we do to decrease inflammation? Well, we can avoid these pro-inflammatory food components, saturated fat, sodium, something called endotoxins, new 5GC, but basically minimize the intake of meat, dairy, tropical oils, and salt. I mean, one lousy breakfast can double our C-reactive protein levels within 4 hours before it's even lunchtime. Wow. And we can also, it's not just enough to get rid of the bad food, we can also eat foods shown to be anti-inflammatories, such as legumes, your beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils, berries, greens, sodium-free tomato juice or tomato paste, oats, flax seeds, turmeric, ginger, garlic, cinnamon, cocoa powder, dill, green and chamomile teas, and other fiber-rich, anthocyanin-rich, which are the bright berry pigments, and salicylic acid-rich foods. These are foods that have a component of aspirin, not just found in the willow tree, but actually throughout the plant kingdom, and may have beneficial effects.
Well, thanks again for the question, Anne. We have a number of emails. Let's go through a few of these. Kevin says, can you comment on the value of organic food and the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen and Clean 15?
That's a great question from Kevin. You know, in How Not to Age, I talk about this important modeling study, which suggested that if half of Americans eat just a single more serving of fruits or vegetables every day, we would prevent every year 20,000 cases of cancer. That's how powerful fruits and vegetables are. But because they're talking about conventional fruits and vegetables, pesticide-laden fruits and vegetables, the extra pesticide burden on the American public would cause 10 cases of cancer. So overall, we would just prevent 19,990 cases of cancer a year. That gives you a sense of the tremendous benefit of eating more produce versus the tiny bump in risk. Now you say, wait a second. Why accept any risk at all by choosing organic? Fantastic. But we should never let concern over pesticides prevent us from stuffing our faces with as many fruits and vegetables as possible.
Kevin also wanted to ask about farm-raised fish like salmon versus wild-caught.
So wild-caught tends to be less polluted than farm-raised. Unfortunately, There's a lot of fraud. It's kind of like extra virgin olive oil, where even if a study shows extra virgin olive oil is better than refined oil, actually trying to find unadulterated extra virgin is very difficult. And similarly, in the seafood industry, there's lots of mislabeling, so it's hard to be sure that you're actually getting wildcat. But regardless, even though it's less harmful, our oceans have essentially become humanity's sewer, right? Everything eventually flows into the sea. So look, if we had a time machine to go back before the Industrial Revolution, that would be one thing. But now the aquatic food chain accumulates the highest levels of chemical pollutants like DDT, PCBs, dioxins. In the U.S., hundreds of thousands of babies are estimated to be born with brain damage every year as a consequence of their mothers consuming mercury-contaminated fish, with the resulting loss of intelligence estimated to cause billions of dollars of lost productivity every year. Look, a tuna sandwich would still be better than bologna, but you know, a hummus wrap would be even healthier, as Harvard researchers found that even just a 3% swap from fish protein to plant protein, like beans, was associated with a 6% decreased risk of premature death.
Mm. Well, thank you for the question. Suzanne writes, my husband eats only keto. Is this healthy? And so keto is, well, can you describe what keto is? High fat, low carb, mostly meat, right?
Definitely a high fat, low carbohydrate diet. Trying to achieve kind of a ketotic state, which is what you see with prolonged fasting. It doesn't necessarily have to involve lots of meat, but it does tend to be very unhealthy. There's these large observational studies looking at hundreds of thousands of people followed for decades, found that the more people eat on the low carb end of the spectrum, the shorter their lives are, the sicker that they are. And then we have interventional studies where you actually randomize people, in what's called a metabolic ward study. So you actually control exactly what's going into their, systems, and you can show the negative effects of switching to ketogenic diets, including excess lean muscle mass loss, and actually a slowing down of body fat, dissolution. And so, it looks great on the scale, though. You lose a lot of water weight. But actually what's happening inside your body, you're actually slowing down your loss of body fat. But it's great for, you know, selling lots of books. This is the original kind of Atkins diet, goes back decades, comes back over and over again. Because, you know, who doesn't want to be told that they're, good news about their bad habits, right? Who doesn't want to be told, oh my God, put butter on your steak or whatever? But unfortunately, the truth is much more prosaic and maybe less tasty, certainly less rich and extravagant. But again, you know, we're talking about our leading killer diseases, and the number one thing we can do to live long, healthy lives is control what we eat. Now, look, it doesn't matter what we eat on our birthdays, holidays, special occasions. It's the day-to-day stuff that adds up. And on a day-to-day basis, we really should try to center our diets around, you know, whole plant foods. So minimizing processed foods, meat, dairy, sugar, eggs, salt, while maximizing fruits, vegetables, whole grains, the legumes, nuts and seeds, mushrooms, herbs and spices, these real foods that grow out of the ground, that are our healthiest choices.
And it's also amazing to learn about how fast things can change. I mean, the body is just amazing. I hope we have some time. I want to share a couple of facts in your book about our brains and our DNA. I mean, just to really think about just what our body is capable of. I think we just don't think about that enough. But you write about the C-reactive protein, or CRP, the most widely studied inflammatory biomarker for predicting remaining lifespan. Having higher CRP levels in your blood may increase your risk of dying prematurely by 42%. According to more than 20 studies, those who eat more plant-based diets have lower CRP levels. And you point out this really interesting study based on the Low Inflammatory Foods Everyday Life Diet by Dr. Joel Fuhrman. And it successfully lowered CRP. Participants were encouraged to limit their consumption of animal products. And then one of the studies looked at those who drank a green smoothie every day without making any other changes to their diet. They saw an astounding 40% reduction in CRP in just 1 week.
And I just want to underscore that this was not them cutting out meat. This is not them cutting out the pro-inflammatory food components, just consuming the anti-inflammatory dark green leafy vegetables in the green smoothies had this dramatic drop, probably the fastest diet-induced reduction in CRP ever reported in the medical literature. And dark green leafy vegetables come up over and over again. I mean, chapter after chapter in terms of improving one's cognition, improving one's vision, slowing down one's metabolic rate, something you normally only see with kind of severe caloric restriction. But instead of starving all the time, you can just sit down to a big salad. Significantly improves muscle mass, muscle strength, muscle performance. So Popeye was right, though not about the pipe smoking, but definitely about eating your spinach.
Mm, so many amazing studies in here about the power of greens and, of course, berries and so many other foods. I wish we had more time. A few other basic questions from listeners. Kevin writes, what is your opinion on white flour?
I encourage people to stay away from refined foods in general. So what you do is you take whole wheat and you remove much of the fiber and turn basically 100% whole wheat bread to white bread. The only exception in terms of the detrimental effects, pasta production, the high-pressure methods used to extrude pasta means that whether you're eating 100% whole wheat pasta, which is something that I stick to, versus white flour pasta, actually has no difference in terms of glycemic index, in terms of the blood sugar spikes in one's bloodstream. You're still missing out on the fiber, so you're missing out on the prebiotics that'd be feeding your good gut flora. But it's less important what kind of pasta you choose, but more important what kind of bread you choose. Ideally, it would be something that actually had entire, so cracked wheat would be better, or entire wheat berries or rye berries like pumpernickel bread would be better. Fortunately, bread is a leading source of sodium for those between 50 and 70 in the United States. And so I encourage people to moderate their intake or get no salt added bread. You can get that. There's an Ezekiel brand bread, which has some legumes added as well, which doesn't have sodium added. It's all about, I know you can kind of get lost in the weeds, but it's just there, you know, food is a zero sum game. Every time we put something in our mouth, there's an opportunity cost, a lost opportunity to put something even healthier in our mouth. So, you know, eating something like a banana, that's not unhealthy, but blueberries are healthier than bananas. So if you have a choice of what to put on your oatmeal and you have a choice, you have the access, look, you know, blueberries would be better. Similarly, for bad foods, you know, are eggs good for you? Well, compared to breakfast sausage, yes. Compared to oatmeal, not even close. You know, so it's not that foods are good or bad, but they're better or worse. And we can continue to try to notch up, ramp up our diet. Eggs, we get healthier and healthier, particularly, of course, because it's the leading indicator of our expected lifespan.
Dr. Greger, there are so many things I wanted to get to, but we don't have time. I just want to mention these for people who want to get your book. You write about the dangers of processed meat, salt. This was huge. And to learn about all the salt in chicken nowadays, I had no idea that so much salt was in chicken. You have a lot of information about cancer information, antioxidant supplements, selenium, vitamin C. The one thing I also just wanted to focus on, just because, again, to focus on the fact that it's not too late, the body is amazing. I mean, you write, every year you are reborn. You destroy and create anew nearly your entire body weight in cells every year. About 50 billion of your cells die each day, but about 50 billion new cells are born. I mean, I just think this speaks to the power of taking action now, because you can make changes no matter what you did last week or last year.
And so it's literally, we are what we eat. So if you're building a structure, right, and you use really cheap, shoddy building materials, you should not be surprised if you end up with a structure that's, you know, not very helpful. And so, yeah, this understanding that we get, we're really kind of built anew. And what are we built out of? We're only built out of air, sun, water, food. Like, that's it. There's nothing else, right? And so by controlling those aspects, we can, you know, no wonder we can so rapidly improve our health situation, even to the point of reversing chronic diseases. The fact that, you know, in Dean Ornish's study, these were people in their 60s who've been eating terrible their whole lives. And the moment they stopped eating these unhealthy foods like animal products, they started opening up those arteries without drugs, without surgery, suggesting their bodies wanted to be healthy all along, but were just never given the chance. You know, one of the most amazing things I learned in all my medical training was that within 15 years of stopping smoking, your lung cancer risk approaches that of a lifelong non-smoker. Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that amazing? Your lungs can clear out all that tar, and eventually it's almost as if you never started smoking at all. And every morning of our smoking life, that healing process starts until, wham, first cigarette of the day. Re-injuring our lungs with every puff, just like we can re-injure our arteries with every bite, when all we had to do all along, the miracle cure, is to just stand back, get out of the way, and stop re-damaging ourselves, and let our body's natural healing processes bring us back towards health.
Wow. And I'm sure over the years, you've seen so many success stories.
Some of which are featured in the new documentary.
Right. And just to let people know, so they got identical twins together, and one of the twins eats a meat-based diet. The other twin eats a plant-based diet, and then they exercise and they take their blood and their levels. And
yeah, I'm really excited. And this was done with a very prestigious lab in at UC San Francisco. I'm glad it's getting out there. It was a great study. It was published in the peer-reviewed medical literature. I'm going to do a video about it, but mm-hmm. You know, it's unfortunately there's this barrier where people just don't have access to these medical journals, so it's nice to have something that is, you know, palatable, easily understandable. And that's how I kind of see my role, is taking all the science and try to make it into kind of practical day-to-day grocery store type decisions.
Well, that documentary Dr. Greger is featured in is called You Are What You Eat. It is on Netflix now. Dr. Michael Greger is author of the new book, How Not to Age, The Scientific Approach to Getting Healthier as You Get Older. He is the founder of NutritionFacts.org, a science-based nonprofit that offers more than 2,000 free videos on virtually every aspect of healthy eating. Dr. Greger is founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Dr. Greger, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us again.
I had such a blast.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.